Good morning. It's very good to be with you this morning for this 15th annual Conference of Cards and Payments Australasia. As a newcomer to this event, I want to take the opportunity today to talk about the economics of the card payments industry, how it differs from other markets, and also to talk about the Reserve Bank's approach to card payments regulation. Card payments are an important part of the infrastructure of a modern economy. All of us here today, I'm sure, appreciate the convenience of being able to pay by plastic. More to the point, card payments make up a considerable slice of spending in the retail economy. There are currently about 40 million debit cards on issue in Australia and about 20 million credit and charge cards. On those cards, nearly 20 million transactions are made per day, and they amount to a value of about $1 billion a day. To put that in some sort of perspective, that's equivalent to about half the value of household consumption in any given period. Card payments are a big proportion of the number of non-cash payments in the economy, but they're only a small proportion of the overall value. More card payments are made in Australia than are made by other forms of non-cash payment combined, but in terms of value, they only account for about 3% of the total. That illustrates that while card payments have few implications for the overall stability of the financial system, they have some very important implications for the system's efficiency. When I talk about efficiency in this context, I'm referring not just to efficiency in an operational sense, that is the efficiency of the processes by which payments are made, but I'm also referring to the efficiency of price signals, the way that price signals guide decisions and guide resources to their best use. The RBA has a mandate to use its regulatory powers where needed to promote that broader efficiency goal through its Payment System Board. I'll talk more about the board's activities in a moment, but let me start with some observations about the economics. One of the first things that I learned when I started to work on card payments is that the economics of this industry are not simple. In the simplest markets, we like to think of supply and demand as being determined by a set of independent decisions made by producers and consumers. People base those decisions on things like the price of the product, its quality, and the cost of production. And if it's a competitive market, we'd expect it to have certain characteristics, such as that other things equal, a lower price means more demand, producers compete to offer the product at the lowest price that they can, and in those conditions we would expect the price mechanism to work in a way that promotes efficiency by guiding resources to their best use. In practice, no market is going to meet those conditions perfectly. But the card payments market has some particular qualities that make it very different from the stylized description that I've just given. First of all, the card payments market is subject to network externalities, which is another way of saying that the cost-benefit decisions made by the various participants in the market are highly interdependent. The value of the service that I get from holding a card depends upon the size of the network. Cardholders value having a card because they know that it's widely accepted, and on the other side of the market, merchants value the capacity to accept a card when they know that that card is widely held. This aspect of the market adds a degree of complexity to the pricing strategies of the participants, because participants will naturally want to take those externalities into account. They have an incentive to adopt pricing strategies that will promote the size of their networks. The second difference is that card payment services are a joint product. the purchaser of the service in any given transaction is not the only person who benefits from it. When a card is used to make a payment, it delivers a service jointly both to the payer and to the receiver of the funds. Thirdly, the card payments market, particularly in the credit card space, has evolved in such a way as to have a very unusual characteristic, and that is that the decision maker in a transaction, the person who decides which payment method to use, is generally not the person who is on the receiving end of the price signal. To be specific, it's typically the purchaser who decides whether to use a card and which card to use, but it's the merchant who, in the first instance, pays the fee associated with that decision. So, in a world where cards are widely held and widely accepted, the effective demand for the service is determined mainly by the card holders, while the price is charged to the merchants. And this is where, in the four-party schemes, interchange fees play a key role, because they're typically passed on to the merchants, and they therefore set a base for the merchant service fee. It's this third characteristic that, to my mind, most clearly distinguishes card payments markets from other markets. We can think of examples of other markets that are subject to significant network effects or where there are jointly produced outputs, but I can't think of any other market where the separation of decision-making power from the price signal is such an integral part of the structure. To put it in simple terms, the cardholder makes the decision, but the merchant pays the fee. And in the pre-reform days, the merchants were restricted from passing that fee on to the customer making the decision. It remains true, of course, that merchants do have some decision-making power of their own. They can, for example, choose not to accept a card, that is, to stay outside a card network if they think that it's too expensive. But this is where a fourth characteristic of the market comes into play, and that is that the card market is highly concentrated. In credit cards, for example, the two major schemes in Australia have a combined market share of more than 80% of transactions. They have high levels of penetration of the potential cardholder market and high rates of acceptance among merchants. These conditions can make it very unattractive for an individual merchant to stay outside a given card network, particularly in a world where the merchant doesn't know what cards a customer might be holding in their wallets. I don't say any of that, by the way, as a criticism of the card schemes. It wouldn't be fair to blame them just for being successful, but it is an important feature of the market that has a bearing on competition and efficiency. One of the consequences of the industry structure that I've just described is that competitive discipline on interchange fees has been weak. As I said before, in conventional markets, competition puts downward pressure on prices because if you raise your price above the prevailing market price, you're going to lose market share. But in card payments, there are significant pressures going the other way. A rise in the interchange fee charged to acquirers can allow issuers to increase their reward points to cardholders, thereby encouraging use of the card. In other words, a rise in price can lead to an increase rather than a decrease in the effective demand for the service. Again, I can't think of any other significant market where that is the case. This principle creates a natural tendency for average interchange fees to drift upwards over time. Within each scheme, there are multiple cards with differing interchange fees, and market share tends to drift towards those cards with the higher fees. It's an illustration of the principle that in these rather unique conditions, competition for market share tends to push price up rather than down. Now, what I've just said is obviously not a complete description to the cards market. There's more to cards payments than that. But I think it does capture those features which are particularly distinctive from a regulator's point of view and which raise at least the potential for concerns about efficiency and the adequacy of competition. With that background, I'll turn now to the Reserve Bank's involvement in card payments regulation. The origin of that involvement was the decision by the federal government in 1997 to implement the Wallace recommendations by giving regulatory oversight of the payment system to the Reserve Bank. The Act sets up a payment system board of the Reserve Bank with responsibility for payment system efficiency and stability. Among other things, the Act gives the board the power to designate a payment system and, where a system has been designated, to set regulatory standards with respect to such things as fees and operating rules. The Payment System Board's first major study in this area was conducted jointly with the ACCC, and that was released in October 2000. That study raised a number of concerns about market practices in the industry, particularly the setting of scheme interchange fees and a range of other matters related to competition and the efficiency of price signals. Since industry attempts to address ACCC concerns about interchange fees had failed, and given that the Payment System Board had a clear mandate in this area, the board then moved into a process of reform, starting with the credit card schemes. After a period of consultation, the first package of credit card reforms was announced in August 2002. That package had three main elements, which were a cost-based standard for interchange fees, disallowance of no surcharge rules, and rules to expand access to the network. That was the initial package in 2002, but the bank was always of the view that payments reform needed to focus on the system more widely. So over the next few years, the reform process added a number of other elements which covered both credit and debit cards. Some of the key ones were a restriction on the Honour All Cards rule to allow merchants to make separate acceptance decisions for credit and debit cards, a cap on Visa debit interchange, which was also voluntarily adopted by MasterCard, a reduction in interchange fees for FPOS, agreement by the three-party schemes to remove no steering rules, access regimes for a number of card payment systems, and increased transparency of interchange fees and merchant service fees. Taken together, that expanded package of reforms was in place by the beginning of 2007. These developments have been closely watched, both by regulators and by market participants around the world, because Australia was the first major country to begin reforms in this area. Subsequently, a number of other countries have taken steps of a similar nature, and there are some others that are currently considering the case to do so. The sequence of reforms that I've just outlined obviously has some complexity to it, and it contains a number of interrelated elements. But at a strategic level, it can be thought of as addressing the concerns about efficiency in two main ways. In the first place, the board took the view that, left to itself, the market was delivering interchange fees that were too high. Hence, they took direct action to regulate them lower. As a result, average credit card interchange fees have fallen from about 95 basis points before the reforms to around 50 basis points now. Merchant service fees associated with the large credit card schemes have correspondingly fallen, and in fact they've fallen by more than the drop in interchange fees. And this in turn has put downward pressure on the fees charged by the three-party schemes. Interchange fees for scheme debit and for FPOS have also been reduced by direct regulation. So that was the first strategic element, was direct regulation of fees lower. Secondly, the various other elements of the reform package can be thought of as working to improve the alignment between price signals and decision-making power, which is the issue that I spoke about earlier. And that can mean either improving the flow of price signals to the decision-maker or giving the fee payer greater influence over the decision. One very important aspect of all that has been the disallowance of no surcharge rules. It's important to be clear on the rationale for that. We're not saying that surcharging is an end in itself or that it's going to be right for all circumstances. But rules against surcharging represent a restriction on the flow of price signals to the decision maker, and so the option to surcharge needs to be there. And where surcharging reflects the costs incurred in the provision of the payment service, it should contribute to efficient outcomes. Another way of improving the alignment that I spoke about earlier has been to remove restrictions on the ability of merchants to influence the choice of payment method at the point of sale. Examples of such measures include the regulation to allow separate acceptance choices on scheme debit and credit, and also the dropping of no steering rules. These things give the fee payer greater scope to respond to the relative prices that are being charged. Finally, and working in the same direction, moves to increase transparency have helped to provide information to merchants and to make them aware of the costs of accepting different payment instruments. This transparency has supported the other elements of the reforms that provided merchants with more competitive leverage. I don't claim that perfection can be achieved on any of these fronts, but these were all areas where improvements needed to be made. The general principle is that if you're paying a fee, there should be some commensurate degree of influence over the decision to incur that fee. Without that, price signals will be ineffective and competitive pressure to keep fees down will be weak. Now, I've gone through that history in order to convey the overall sweep of card payments regulation and the general economic basis for it. Having done that, let me move on to look at the current position. The immediate background at this point is the review of card payments reforms that the board undertook in 2007 and 2008. In thinking about the approach taken in that review, it's worth keeping in mind that the Reserve Bank has described itself as a reluctant regulator. Our general mandate with respect to the payment system is to promote efficiency and stability. For reasons that I've already described, that includes taking measures to stop fees from rising too far above efficient levels. But our preference is to do that, when we can, by promoting competition rather than by direct regulation of fees. Well, the results of the board's review were presented in September 2008. So what did it find? First of all, it found that the reforms to date had delivered significant benefits in the form of lower costs to merchants and increased competition. In addition, it found that price signals had been strengthened, transparency enhanced, access improved, and that the competitive environment was now more soundly based than it had been 5 years earlier. But the board also concluded that more needed to be done. Specifically, it concluded that at 50 basis points, credit card interchange fees were still too high. It also concluded that with the various reforms to date in place, even with those reforms, competitive pressures were still not strong enough to put downward pressure on fees if the direct regulation were removed. Against that background, the board set out two possible approaches for the next stage of its regulatory strategy. The first possible approach would be to step back from interchange fee regulation if it could be reasonably satisfied that this was not going to result in fees going back up again. Within that broad approach, the board saw two ways that this objective might be met through action by the payments industry. One was by strengthening competition from alternative payment methods, particularly through development of industry-based FPOS and online payment schemes, coupled with further changes to the Honourable Cards Rule and increased transparency of scheme fees. The other was by voluntary undertakings from the credit card schemes that interchange fees would not rise. So taking all that together, that was the first possible approach that the board considered. The second possible approach put forward in the 2008 review was to maintain interchange regulation on credit card schemes and to make a further reduction to 30 basis points. The board indicated that it would follow this path if progress on the first track was not satisfactory. Now, as you know, the board undertook to make an assessment of that in August 2009. As you also know, the decision at that point was deferred. The board took the view that good progress was being made by the industry, but that it wasn't yet enough to provide sufficient confidence that fees would be held down in the absence of direct regulation. So the decision was to allow some further time to assess developments. In the meantime, the board did make one further change of a more limited nature, which was needed to put the new FPOS scheme on a comparable regulatory footing to scheme debit. And that announcement was made in November last year. I know that many of you involved in the industry would like me to give some predictions or clues today about what the board's next decision on these matters might be. I'm not in a position to make that kind of prediction today, but what I hope I've done is to convey some of the principles that are important. To reiterate, the Reserve Bank is a reluctant regulator. We prefer to see fees being held down by competition rather than by direct regulation. We believe there's been good progress in promoting competition over recent years, but it's not yet clear whether that will be sufficient. And hence, the board's announcement in August last year explicitly left on the table both of the two broad approaches that I outlined earlier. Let me conclude on a somewhat different note. I've talked mainly today about the Payment Systems Board's approach to card regulation. But obviously there's more to the card payments industry than just interchange fees and regulation. This is an industry that's rapidly innovating, it's developing new ways to offer services, and it's also facing continuing challenges, for example, in the areas of fraud and security. I expect that you'll be focusing mainly on those wider issues over the next few days, and I want to wish you every success with the rest of the conference, and I thank you very much for the invitation to speak today. Thank you.
Dr. Eddie, Kai Chow from the Sky News Business Channel. I'm just wondering how you... I just have a couple of brief questions. First is on inflation. How do you see Australia's current state of inflation, considering you have a very strong consumer market, but a lot of businesses are still finding it difficult to get funding? It's almost like we have a two-speed type of economy. And the second, you spoke last year about your concerns about loan losses could be ahead. There was still some financial risk in the system. Just wondering what your current evaluation of Australia's level of financial risk is in our system as well.
Okay, thanks. There were a few elements to that question. Part of it related to inflation and the macroeconomic position, and I have to say on that I'm no longer a spokesman on the macro economy. I'm focused on the financial sector, so I'm going to try and just pick out the parts of your question that related to those areas. One part of your question was about financial risk and loan losses. I think globally, this question of whether banks' loan losses have peaked is an important issue to focus on. In some of the major economies, particularly the United States and in Europe, it seems as though banks' loan losses are rising from the financial crisis and from the recent recession, it appears that those are still rising and that there's still some way for that to play out. I think in Australia, though, the position is a lot better than that. The evidence now is that banks' loan losses have peaked, the profitability is improving, and the condition of the financial sector, it was always more resilient than the rest of the world, and I think the evidence is fairly clear now that the position of the financial sector in Australia is improving. Having answered that question, I think I've forgotten the other part of it, if you want to have another go at that.
Yeah, well, how are you about the inflation picture? I understand you can't speak, but on the level of financial risk, you were concerned about loan losses previously, and so, you know, is that still a major, how concerned are you now about loan losses, for example, in commercial loans?
Well, there are some areas in bank lending that have experienced higher losses than others, and commercial property is probably the main example of that. But the good news for Australian banking is that by far the largest part of the balance sheet is lending for housing, and those loans have performed very well. Loan losses are very low, and so that's been an important factor in keeping the overall health of banks' balance sheets in very good shape. But just to return to the point that I made earlier, even taking all of that together, the evidence now seems to be that banks' loan losses have peaked.
Any further questions? This is your chance to talk to the regulator.
Hello, Russell Bryant from Bank of New Zealand. When you did your initial study prior to regulating credit cards, you decided to have a cost basis for the credit card price, and you came out at 50 basis points, and you've now subsequently decided that that's not the right price and it's too high, and you're now holding 30 basis points as the price of that, a cost-based decision or?
Okay, so the question was when we started regulating interchange fees, we had a cost-based approach. That was broadly how we came up with the 50 basis points. What's the rationale for considering going lower? The way I would like to answer that is by saying that cost isn't the only factor. One way of thinking about this is to come back to what I said earlier about card payments being a joint product which provides a service both to the merchant and to the purchaser. Now, if you think of this business on a cost recovery basis, and you thought there was a case for the entirety of the costs to just fall on one side of the market, then that would justify an approach that put all of the costs onto the acquirer who services the merchant, and if that was your argument, then you would say that the issuer or the card holder would bear none of that cost. To my way of thinking, that suggests an upper bound on what would be a justifiable price, because it takes a one-sided approach that puts all of the cost on one side of the market. Now, other people could make an argument that would say, well, the cost of providing that service actually should be shared between the people who benefit, and if that's the case, then that would argue for 50 basis points being an upper bound on the cost rather than being a target that you should aim for. So that's one way of approaching the question, but I think there's another point that also needs to be made here, which is that the approach of the Payment System Board is not focused solely on cost. It's also focused on the question of how does the pricing structure of the industry affect decision-making, and is pricing occurring in a way that distorts decisions. Now, one of the things that we've been concerned about, and this has been spelled out in our various publications and reports over the years, is that the flow of interchange fees from acquirers to issuers provides what can effectively be used as a cross-subsidy to support the issuance of cards and usage of cards by the card holders. And if that cross-subsidy is distorting the market and giving credit cards a competitive advantage over other systems that may actually be more cost-effective in an operational sense, then that is a concern for the board. So those are the sorts of things that the board's been focused on, and those are the sorts of arguments that justify a general view that 50 basis points, even though it was originally based on a cost calculation, is actually higher than we'd like to see it.